Higher Education Budget Division will come to order. Today is the first of 2 days we're going to be talking with the University of Minnesota. I'd like to welcome President Bob Brunix here today, and I hope that other legislators who haven't arrived yet will hear my voice and will come quickly. Although President Brunix is going to be giving quite a lengthy presentation, please feel free to ask questions. And if we run out of time today, we will be continuing on Thursday. The beginning of the day, the President is going to be talking about transforming the U and the strategic planning process and the budget development process. And we've given him and the staff kind of some questions that we wanted them to address and how the 2005 appropriations were spent. Then we're going to start looking at the new initiatives, and we have authors for those that will then join the President at the table to talk a little bit about their initiative that they're championing. And we don't have bill numbers yet. The bills, I think, are all going to be introduced on Thursday. So we won't take we'll take our action that we take laid over for consideration on Thursday. And with that, do I have any other announcements? Yes, there is a mini conference at the Carlson School, and you have flyers at your place, the Minnesota International Center and the Association of International Educators. And I especially want Senator Tomasoni to see this thing because it looks like it's very relevant to his committee, mm-hmm. International Education Exchange, the Centerpiece for Global Workforce Development. And I'm planning on going, and I invite it's not going to be a committee assignment, but if any of you can free up your schedules, I know how difficult that is, but I think it would be worthwhile. Okay. Senator, welcome again, President Brunix.
Senator Pappas, members of the committee, it's a great pleasure to be with you today to have an opportunity to present the university's biennial budget requests for fiscal 2008 and 2009. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce Regent Stephen Hunter, who has joined us from the University of Fourth Regents. And I have a number of other colleagues to back me up if you get me into the deep end of the pool. We may ask a couple of them to join us here at the table. I regularly am asked to talk about the university and its future. And one of the things I find myself often saying is that this is not only a great university, but it's one that has a really long history in the state of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota was actually formed when Minnesota was a territory, not yet a state, and it enjoys a 157-year history of real accomplishment and impact on the state of Minnesota. And I find it always inspiring to say that because it reminds me that the people who settled this territory thought that one of the most important priorities was to invest in education and to establish a university for their sons and daughters. We happen to enjoy a great history, of achievement and accomplishment and impact in the state of Minnesota, largely because the legislative leaders in previous decades and governors have strongly supported higher education in Minnesota. And I just want to add that I think the University of Minnesota has benefited greatly from the commitment and interest of this committee and I think the people who have come before you. So I'm going to try to get through a lot of material. As Senator Pappas said, she asked that we address a broad range of things besides the budget itself. And so I'm going to first of all talk about the university's strategic positioning plan. I'm going to go over that very quickly, but at least give you a sense of what we're trying to do to transform the university and make it a much more productive and effective university. I'll introduce the university's biennial budget request for the next two fiscal years. I'll also try to make some links between the request itself and what we are undertaking with respect to our strategic plan and positioning efforts. And I'll also talk about the meaning of this budget request, not only for the university, but for our state. When people talk about the University of Minnesota, they frequently think about the Twin Cities campus, and that's sort of a natural thing. But they often fail to appreciate the statewide reach and the statewide impact of the University of Minnesota. Represented on these dots, and these are only a few of the dots and symbols that I think represent the placement and activities of the university on a statewide basis, our 28 million assignable square feet of space that we manage throughout the state of Minnesota, and I might argue the oldest buildings and historic buildings in the entire state of Minnesota. Represented on this graph or this map are research labs, clinics, greenhouses, animal hospitals, something called area health education centers that are scattered around the state, regional health and dental clinics, classrooms, offices, performance spaces, student unions, housing, steam plants, in short, a whole city, a city that includes at least 85,000 people on a daily basis. The university system has 5 campuses, Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and the Twin Cities. In Crookston, we have a relatively small campus of nearly 2,000 students. They study in 24 undergraduate degree programs, mostly in fields like agriculture, arts, humanities, and social sciences, business, mathematics, science and technology, and natural resources. The campus is expanding its emphasis on internet-based education, online degrees, and business and manufacturing management. I think one of the things that I should say about Crookston, though, it's more than a campus. This is a location and a regional place for the University of Minnesota. It's the home of the Northwest Regional Research and Outreach Center, one of our leading agricultural research stations in the state of Minnesota. It's the home of a regional area health education center, the center that I just mentioned, focusing on rural health issues and extending the reach of its work throughout the state of Minnesota. And it offices next to the Minnesota Rural Health Association. And it's a regional center for one of the University of Minnesota Extension offices. The University of Minnesota Duluth is one of our larger campuses, 11,000-plus students who can study in 5 bachelor degree programs and 75 majors, graduate programs, 20 fields. We have a 2-year program at our School of Medicine, where people can study rural medicine and transfer to the university's Twin Cities campus to complete their degree. Next spring, we will graduate the first class of our College of Pharmacy, and there are a number of academic cooperative programs with the Twin Cities campus. UMD consistently ranks among the top Midwestern comprehensive regional universities when you look at ratings like U.S. News and World Report. And one of the things people often fail to recognize is the faculty and staff at UMD are very active in seeking outside grants and contracts, nearly $17 million in the last 2 fiscal years. The University of Minnesota Morris is a campus of about 1,800 students. Students study in 30 different majors. It's one of the most academically rigorous public liberal arts colleges in the upper Midwest. Nearly 50% of the students who graduate from the Morris campus go on to graduate and professional degree programs in colleges and universities throughout the United States. Interestingly, Morris started as a territorial Indian school in the 1800s. It was a boarding school, and when the property was deeded from the federal government to the state of Minnesota, there was a stipulation that all American Indian students who elected to apply to and were accepted to study at the University of Minnesota Morris could study at that campus without paying tuition. When I started as provost of the University of Minnesota approximately 10 years ago, we had a budget crisis on our hands with respect to the University of Minnesota Morris because the number of American Indian students had increased from something like 55 to 75 in a particular year. This fall, 170 American Indian students from all over the United States are studying at Morris with very, very high achievement levels and graduation rates. I think it is truly a national model. But it is a model that exists today as an unfunded federal mandate and something I hope we can correct because it does put some real strain on the university's budget. But I think it's the right thing to do.
Mr. President, do you know how many of those are Minnesota Indian kids and how many are out of state?
I can get you the figures, but I think the majority of the students are from Minnesota. But the interesting thing is that when students come from other states and study at any of our campuses, about 70% of them elect to stay here after graduation and make their living here and contribute to our quality of life. And so I think it's a really good program in developing leadership in the American Indian community and in communities throughout the state.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Brunix, I'm just wondering, if they are from families that are eligible for Pell Grants or state grants, can the university get that income, or can you not receive anything?
Mr. President.
Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling, yes, we can access the regular federal and state grant programs if they're eligible for those programs. And so you combine university support with those other available sources of funding. But if they don't qualify as Pell-eligible students, let's say their family incomes are $45,000 or $50,000, then the university is obligated under this treaty to make up the difference.
Thank you.
There's one other I just should say as a matter of history. I looked into this because I thought it was curious that that the federal government didn't fund this mandate. And so I found that there was one other college in Colorado, and Senator Campbell, when Light Horse Campbell, when he was in the Senate, managed to take care of that budget problem. And we're still working on it in Minnesota. Anyway, the other thing I should say about Morris is, much like Crookston, it's a place in the state where the university has multiple activities, again, a thriving research and outreach center. And one of the signature qualities of or attributes of Morris is that increasingly it has been a campus and a research station devoted to renewable energy and experimentation in renewable energy. On that particular site, you will find a wind turbine that provides 60% of the energy to the Morris campus. We're about to build an experimental biomass heating plant facility there, and so it's tied very much into the university's renewable energy agenda. And, of course, the emphasis is finding its way into academic majors and emphases on the campus as well. The University of Minnesota Rochester offers doctoral, master's, and baccalaureate degrees. In addition to various certificate and licensure programs, we have thriving partnerships with Rochester and Community and Technical College, Winona State University. A number of non-credit courses are offered through continuing education and professional development programs as well. And it is the home of the University of Minnesota's largest extension office, a very thriving office, and an increasingly important research technology transfer office. It's also the home of thriving academic partnerships, mostly with the Mayo Clinic, Hormel Institute, in areas of academic health, and increasingly involves research partnerships with technology-based industries in the greater Rochester area. Last year, the Twin Cities campus was the second largest campus in the United States, and I would argue a campus with the most diverse academic fields in the nation. More than 50,000, close to 53,000 students are enrolled at the Twin Cities campus in undergraduate, graduate, and professional degree programs. It's one of only four campuses in the entire nation with a medical school, a business school, a college of agriculture, a veterinary college, and a law school. One of the most complex institutions in the country, but that complexity allows for all kinds of opportunities, what we call interdisciplinary opportunities that bring people together in multiple fields to create some very important work. For example, the University of Minnesota was a recipient of one of the first two Homeland Security Research grants. It involves a consortium of multiple universities in the upper Midwest and other locations around the country. It's devoted to food safety. It also involves thriving partnerships with private sector businesses in Minnesota and elsewhere. In addition, on this map, you'll see that the university has 18 regional extension offices with county-based 4-H programs, 15 other locations with research centers and outreach centers, and I mentioned four regional health education centers and clinics. So I just wanted to give you a sense that from this map and these few comments that this is a university with statewide reach, located in multiple places throughout Minnesota and really addressing a wide range of needs with respect to research, education, and the public responsibilities of the University of Minnesota. I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes talking about the University of Minnesota's distinctive mission, its academic profile for just a moment. And I think one of the things that sets the University of Minnesota apart from other public and private institutions in the state and maybe many others around the country is its focus on research and education and the connection of research and education to our public responsibilities. So we are Minnesota's only research and land-grant university established, that is the land-grant part of it, established in 1862. One of the distinctive aspects of our profile is on this slide that you see before you, and that is every year the talented faculty and staff of the University of Minnesota bring in close to $600 million in research awards. It will approximate or exceed $600 million in 2007. Those awards have a profound impact on Minnesota's economy. They also create a thriving technology transfer operation at the University of Minnesota. In a recent study, the University of Minnesota's technology transfer pipeline was ranked fourth best in the nation. The U.S. Department of Commerce estimates that 32 jobs in the private economy are created for every $1 million of university research and development. That's nearly 19,000 jobs in Minnesota in the year 2006. The Department of Commerce further estimates that for every dollar of sponsored research, and most of this money comes from outside of Minnesota into Minnesota, that every dollar spent creates another $1.70 of economic benefit in Minnesota's economy. That's nearly $1 billion annually from this activity alone. I argue that this is one of Minnesota's most significant and positive balance of payments, mostly from federal R&D funding. I often imagine what would happen if we were less successful in this area. We were less successful in attracting money to support research and development in Minnesota. And one day I imagine what would happen if we lost $100 million, which is not improbable if we fail to pay attention to what we need to invest in at the university. $100 million of sponsored funding would translate into 3,000 jobs in Minnesota's private economy and a loss of nearly $150 million a year in private economic activity. And these grim statistics ignore the potential economic benefit that comes from research and discovery, from the Honeycrisp apple to the pacemaker to taconite and many other discoveries that we could talk about. So I think this part of our mission is extraordinarily important to Minnesota and Minnesota's future. The people who graduate from the University of Minnesota study in this kind of environment. They go out, in many cases, form companies in Minnesota. In a survey that we conducted of our alumni, we recently discovered that 10,000 of them, that our alumni had developed 10,000 companies in Minnesota, another 9,000 across the nation. These companies employ 500,000 people in Minnesota, another 600,000 nationally. $100 billion of economic activity is created in the companies founded by these graduates, and another $130 billion outside of Minnesota. Education is obviously at the heart of the University of Minnesota's commitment. And there are more than 65,000 degree-seeking students, at least in the year 2006. About 40,000 of those are undergraduate, close to 17,000 or more are close to 20,000, I should say, are graduate and professional students. Last year, there were 13,000 degrees granted by the University of Minnesota. And nearly 50% of Minnesota's total degrees in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics were awarded by University of Minnesota campuses. And I think that is a very, very significant part of the academic profile of our campus. More than two-thirds, and in some cases close to 80% of the state's advanced healthcare professionals are educated at the University of Minnesota. Doctors, pharmacists, dentists, veterinarians, advanced practice nurses, just to name a few of the fields that are addressed by university work.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator Michel.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And President Brunix, I'm always reluctant to interrupt you. You're on a roll there. But while you were close to this topic, I wanted to ask, do you have a number or a ballpark figure for the number of students who come to your university and stay in Minnesota? Do you have a number for undergraduate, graduate?
From out of state.
Yeah, from out of state.
President Brunix.
Chair Pappas, Senator Michel, I can't give you the precise number, but about 28% of the students who enroll in Twin Cities campus and a somewhat lower percentage on the other campuses come from outside of Minnesota. From the studies that we have conducted, about anywhere from 50 to 70%, depending on the year, end up graduating and staying in Minnesota and contributing to our quality of life. Now, economists call that a talent magnet. You know, is that the university really operates to draw people into the state, and we manage to keep very, very large numbers of them here and pursuing their lives here in Minnesota. So I think that's a big advantage of the University of Minnesota. I think there are selected private colleges that have a similar profile at the undergraduate level that really draw from outside of the state of Minnesota, and I think that's good. That's good for Minnesota's economy. It's good for the future of our state. It's not the only thing that matters. I think we need broad access for people who live here, too, and we need to continue to do that as part of our responsibilities at the university as well.
Thank you.
Well, let me just say a couple of things about translational research, and that is research and its impact on our society. And I think the best way to do that is to give a couple of stories or a couple of examples. Many of you know the groundbreaking research of Ansel Keys, a physiologist who worked from 1936 until his retirement in 1972. And most of his research was done in the interior walls of the old Memorial Football Stadium. Ansel Keys was the person who studied cholesterol and discovered the link between cholesterol and heart disease. Some of our researchers have created more than 50 cold hardy, what we call cold hardy soybean varieties that thrive in Minnesota's climate. Today, our farmers raise roughly 10% of the U.S. total soybean crop, and it represents about one-third of the exports of Minnesota's total agricultural exports. You all know about the state apple. You adopted it last year, the Honeycrisp apple. That's just one of many developed at the University of Minnesota. A professor by the name of E.W. Davis worked in the Institute of Technology for several decades, filed 19 patents, and over that period of time found a way to unlock iron ore and taconite, which had been considered a waste rock prior to his research. This particular set of discoveries absolutely revitalized Minnesota's iron range and continues to have a profound impact today. The university's Richard Duvall, Walt Lillehei, developed the first artificial heart-lung machine, triggering the thriving medical device industry in Minnesota and in the Twin Cities. IT graduate Earl Bakken formed Medtronic. He did so by starting some work in his northeast Minneapolis garage in 1949, and he developed the first reliable battery-powered pacemaker. Dr. Robert Vince, most recently director of our Center for Drug Design in Mihawa, developed a particular kind of compound called Carbivore. It's the basis for a leading AIDS drug called Zyogen, and it's contributed to the treatment of AIDS patients around the world and has benefited hundreds of thousands of AIDS patients over the last few years. Our students have developed and won awards for safety products. How about one recently called Smart Roofing Pants, a bullet-resistant vest for dogs, rock climbing pants. This was all developed in a course taught by a professor by the name of Karen Labatt. I just want to give you a sense that even in the classroom, our students are really engaged with professors in creating ideas and finding ways to apply them to improve our society. I want to spend a little time talking, as Chair Pappas asked me to do, about strategic positioning. It's been a very big focus of the University of Minnesota. It's something we've worked very, very hard on and is very much a continuing process at the University of Minnesota and will be for some years to come. I've always reminded of that great comment by Will Rogers, who once said that even if you think you're on the right path, you can get run over if you just sit there. And I think that very much is the way in which the university feels about its future. We believe that we're at a period with a lot of very important challenges facing the future of higher education in the University of Minnesota. And we felt, as a university community, we needed to take stock of these major trends and challenges, come together as a community, and really try to transform the university's future. I know that's lofty rhetoric, but I can tell you that rhetoric plays out in the conversations and work of the university community each and every day. We felt there were a lot of reasons to step back and undertake a very ambitious strategic planning and positioning process for the first time in a 15-year period. You have increased global competition for funding, for talent, for students. You have declining public investment at the federal and state level that has been basically a 25 to 30-year trend. There's a decline in the federal higher education budget that directly supports students, although we've seen some modest upticks in support that I think are quite promising, but they clearly haven't kept up with inflation in the last 25 years. The people who fund research grants today are increasingly trying to focus their funding and their money on big ideas, ideas that bring people together across multiple fields. We call it interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary. They're trying to really, when it comes to curing cancer or solving serious issues regarding the future of energy, in our society, or whatever the issues might be, there's this tendency to try to organize people across fields, much the way they did in funding the food safety work of our Homeland Security Research Center. Students are also paying more for their education today. And while Minnesota's financial program that is directed at students is probably the third or fourth most generous program in the country, we clearly know that our students are not, and the family incomes that support our students are not keeping up with the rising cost of higher education. And then, of course, we all know the axiom that demography is destiny, and the demographic changes and shifts in our society are quite dramatic. We're getting older. Obviously, we're getting more diverse. We're going to see a decline in high school graduates. We're going to see an increase in the number and percentage of first-generation college students and students from very diverse cultural backgrounds. And all of these issues, taken singly or in combination, we felt provided the context for thinking in a new way about the future of the University of Minnesota and made our efforts to strategically reposition the university, to work together to transform the university's future, an important responsibility and one that we should take very, very seriously. So we started on a path about 2 years ago, about 2.5 years ago. And, of course, you don't get very far at the University of Minnesota without getting the endorsement of the governing board. And we took this idea to the university's governing board. They endorsed it unanimously. And we started on this path that I'm going to talk to you about in just a few moments. The first thing there are many, many parts to this thing, and I could spend more than one or two boring hours talking to you about it.
Just tell us the interesting parts.
I'm going to just give you the highlights and try to skip the lowlights if I can. But one of the things that was very, very important to the university and important to launching this process in the right way was to really get consensus, broad-scale consensus, on an aspirational goal for the university's future. We came to the conclusion that Minnesota is a very special state. It has very special qualities. It has one of the most vibrant economies in the entire world and one of the most innovative economies. Has a high commitment to education and to quality of life. And we thought an aspirational goal for the university's future. The state's research and land-grant university system ought to be sufficiently audacious and aspirational. And so we said we wanted to be among the very best public research universities, not just in the United States, but in the world, recognizing the global, increasingly global position of the university. So I've regularly asked about that aspirational goal, and we said further that we wanted the qualities and the productivity of the University of Minnesota to resemble those universities that were in the top three, to really benchmark and frame this aspirational goal. To me, it's not about being three. It's about being excellent. And it's about getting up every day and pointing the university in the right direction and being very, very committed to the idea of making us more distinctive, more productive, more excellent in everything we do in serving the interests of our students, our faculty, our staff, the citizens of the state of Minnesota, and Minnesota's future.
President Brunix, could you give us an idea of what some of these universities that we're competing with to be in the top three or the top five or the top 10 or whatever?
Well, Chair Pappas and members of the committee, you mean the names of such universities? Yes. There are arguments about where people fall in these comparisons depending on the criteria you examine. But clearly in the top three, we would consider the University of California, Berkeley. It is an extraordinary public university. It doesn't do all the things we do. I mean, I think there are areas here at the university that, frankly, we do better than they do. They don't have a veterinary college, for example. The University of Michigan would clearly be in that group. I think we would argue that you start to get in some arguments. In the next three to four, it's UCLA, North Carolina, Washington. You could argue that Florida and the University of Minnesota are in there. When they do studies, the University of Florida Research Center in Higher Education tracks a set of indicators every year, and the University of Minnesota is in sort of the top three to seven. Increasingly, you find public universities in other places. You could argue Cambridge, Oxford is sort of in the hunt. Increasingly, I think we're going to see some of the universities in China. But in a recent study evaluating 650 research universities around the world, only a very small number came into the top 50 from and this is public and private, in this survey from Europe and other parts of the world. The University of Tokyo was in that top 50. But the point I'm really trying to make is that at least today, the research universities in the United States, public and private, are considered to be among the very best in the world. But increasingly, sort of like my colleague Tim Mulcahy says, the object in your rearview mirror may be closer than you think. They are really nipping at our heels. Countries are really making very deep investments in this area. And we could very, very easily lose the, I think, enviable position that we have nationally and internationally at the present time. We have our work cut out for us, quite frankly.
President Brunix, do European countries do research, public research, outside of a university setting?
Yeah, Chair Pappas, in most countries of the world, you will find a lot of research financed privately through private businesses, particularly if you're looking at technology applications or in the pharmaceutical industry, you'll find a lot of the big pharma companies invest in their own R&D. The difference in the United States is quite significant. And what's interesting when you look at the European Union today or you look at what's happening in Japan and in China and India and other places around the world is more and more those countries and consortiums of countries are modeling the experiment that the United States started on after World War II. At the end of World War II, there was a commission appointed by the President of the United States called the and it was headed up by a person named Vannevar Bush. And he basically, with a very significant committee of people representing the public and private sectors, set out a set of principles and ideas that have served this country extraordinarily well since World War II. And it essentially built a very thriving partnership between federal investment in R&D, the private sector in the United States, and our great universities. And that kind of level of investment and that sustained investment since World War II has created this sort of network that we see in these great universities that really pursue discoveries each and every day and try to make the applications that I think are going to be necessary to improve our world. And it's put the United States in a very, very strong position. But people now recognize that we're moving into more of a knowledge-based, innovation-based economy where our quality of life will depend much more on the creation of ideas than the creation of things. And so there's much more tendency in these countries to invest substantially. The most dramatic examples are in some of the areas of molecular and cellular biology and genetics, and you'll see every once in a while an article in some newspaper that a laboratory group from San Diego is moving, you know, to India or some other place. And so there's a lot of international competition right now. But I still believe the United States is in the strongest position. And one of the things that's really helped the public sector, places like the University of Minnesota, is not only this federal and private sector engagement, but also the strong commitment of our states. I mean, the University of Minnesota would not be a strong university today without state support. I mean, that is the most fungible part of our budget. It's the part of our budget that leverages all the other things that go on at our university, and I'll show you some examples of that in just a few moments. But I think these are really critical issues. It's one of the reasons the National Academy of Sciences just come out with a big report on called the National Competitiveness Report. There's a lot of concern about, you know, what's happening in this area, what we need to do to sustain the top position of the United States when it comes to research, development, and innovation. So I think this is not just a concern of the federal government. It's also something that we ought to be thinking about here. Minnesota does not have a usual economy, and it's a very diverse economy, one that really depends on innovation for its very survival, much more than many other economies throughout the country. That makes it more vibrant, that makes it more entrepreneurial in many ways, what Richard Florida, economist, calls a creative economy. And his measures and others would put us in the top 10. At one time, our per capita income was not in the top 10. It was close to the bottom half. I think it was 29th, nationwide. That was in 1959, according to the research of our Federal Reserve Bank. Well, let me turn to our columns that look a little like Northrop Auditorium, Grand Place on the University of Minnesota campus. And just give you a quick overview of what we're trying to do with strategic positioning. We're trying to change everything at the University of Minnesota, move it in a much more positive and productive direction. This is sort of the basic framework of what we're trying to do. And you can see sort of the architecture that I've shared with you, the vision, the mission, the goal of the University of Minnesota. And we're really now driving this strategic plan and positioning into the core responsibilities that we feel we have as a major university. It's all about improving the quality of education and the outcomes. We want our students to stay at the University of Minnesota, graduate on a timely basis, to learn and be productive, and also be satisfied, highly satisfied with their experiences. It's all about human capital. It's all about investing in attracting talented people, keeping talented people, making sure that they can be productive in the environment of the University of Minnesota. It's all about operating as an exceptional organization. I've often said to people, I'd like us to be known for the quality of our management, the stewardship of our resources, as we are known for the quality of our education, our research, and our public engagement. So if we don't manage ourselves well, I don't think we can be great in the other areas that are part of our responsibility. And we're also talking about innovation. How can we create a culture that's entrepreneurial, that's innovative, that where people come to work every day and think about pushing the frontiers of new ideas, whether it's in the classroom, in the laboratory, in the field, or in engagement in our public responsibilities. So we argue, if you look at the bottom of this diagram, it's all about fostering a culture of excellence. It's all about cultivating an international presence and connection at the University of Minnesota. It's bringing people together across exciting interdisciplinary fields to tackle some of the most critical problems facing our society and world. It's generating the resources we need to be productive and effective. So we come here and we talk to you every year about the resources of the University of Minnesota. But I can tell you, I will spend 3 hours Friday afternoon with many of the people who are in this room thinking about the other things we need to do to grow the resources of the university and also to think about how to use them more efficiently and wisely. And we like to think we're a place that's accountable for results. We produce this report for you every year, which is called, and I have copies for people, Accountable to You. In this report, we track nearly 80 measures. The next version of this report will track over 100 measures. There'll be leading measures embedded in this report that we think are necessary to track our progress, track our impact, provide the kind of energy we need to improve the university each and every day. So strategic positioning, the point I wanted to make, and the point I've made to our board and our university community is that it's not a place. It's a destination. It's something you do each and every day to try to improve your results and improve your impact. On this next slide, you can get a sense of we've had a group of people working on this framework for about the last year and a half. We're refining it. You have a set of what we call leading measures that we're going to track on a regular basis. These measures, I think, will also be deeply embedded in the State Office of Higher Education Accountability Framework. We've been working with Susan Hegard and her colleagues on these issues for the last a couple of years. We've also made some dramatic changes at the University of Minnesota. So strategic positioning isn't all about lofty rhetoric and goals. It's about making changes and improvements on the ground. We closed three colleges and created three new dynamic colleges that we think are going to be important. We reorganized Extension on a statewide basis, and I think Extension is going to be much stronger. We went out to Minnesota's business and corporate community and conducted a survey to find out how we could be more productively connected to places across the, business across the state of Minnesota. We developed a new academic and corporate relations center. We even have one of these branches in the city of Rochester. We've developed four new world-class interdisciplinary institutes, a new Institute for Advanced Study that brings people together around really serious cultural and social issues in our society, a new Institute on the Environment, an Institute for the Advanced Study of Science and Technology to bring people across multiple fields in those areas, and an important new Institute on Translational Neuroscience, one of the fields of research that we think will be one of the most important for the university and our world in the next 100 years. All of these, the question is, how does this relate to the biennial budget request? All of these ideas are embedded in this request and are a major part of this request. We launched an ambitious financial support program for low-income students. We call it the Founders Opportunity Free Tuition Program. And it will, in a four-year period, provide to Pell-eligible students free tuition and fees to attend the University of Minnesota. And we're funding that through reallocation, through private fundraising, through our internal resources. And we're also asking for some modest support as a part of this budget. We started something called the Promise for Tomorrow Scholarship Initiative, and we agreed we'd match private gifts exceeding $25,000. And at the time we started it, people told me you won't raise more than $5 to $7 million a year in this scholarship initiative because at the height of the Minnesota campaign, the most successful fundraising campaign in Minnesota, the University of Minnesota's history, we raised $5 to $7 million. It was the only goal we had to scramble to meet at the end of the campaign. And I said, that's not true. I think we can reach out to people. We can say, let's not be the first generation to pull the ladder of opportunity up behind us. Let's give back to young people. Let's make scholarships a priority. So we agreed to match these gifts. We're now raising scholarship funding at about $50 million a year, and we've more than doubled the number of scholarships and fellowships on the Twin Cities campus. Now, the first thing that someone's going to ask me is, can we substitute private investment for public investment? And that's a long answer, but I can say absolutely not. But this is giving us and our students, I think, a lot more support than they had previously.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I applaud the effort to try and keep tuition costs affordable for students. The question I have, though, is that the students who are fully eligible for Pell and state grants, I'm wondering how much do they have left to pay, and is it practical to give them a full free ride and then leave those families that fall off the cliff right after they become ineligible for Pell and state grants with no aid? And I often think, wouldn't it be better to have each student be partly responsible for their own education in some capacity than to give some people a complete free ride while the other ones maybe don't even choose your institution because it's too expensive and their families can't afford it?
President Brunix.
Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling, it's a very good question, and I think it's a question that we're increasingly asking around the country. Let me put this, frame this at least, though, in some context. The average family income of the students we're targeting with this program is about $26,000 a year, based on our modeling of our current student population. Secondly, one of the things the Promise for Tomorrow Scholarship program does is it reaches these students whose family incomes are slightly higher, and so there's an attempt to, with state, the state grant program also does that. But I think you've pointed out an area of public policy that needs some attention, quite frankly, because the strain on families with incomes roughly between $40,000 a year and $100,000 a year, particularly if they have more than one son or daughter in a college or university, is quite substantial. Now, they can access college savings programs and accumulate some down payments against the cost of higher education through tax-deferred savings programs and tax deductions of one kind or another. But you often have to have much higher income to really to leverage those benefits in a very, very substantial way. So one of the things we're looking at now is what can we do to reach more and more of those families. We do that in a variety of ways through work-study programs, through employment programs on our campus that allow the students to study and work in the same place. That we try to keep the cost of loans quite manageable. We manage our own loan programs, and I have Vice Provost Craig Swan here who could answer this question more deeply. But anyway, I do think you put your finger on something we need to work on, and we're clearly trying to do what we can internally. The state grant program, I think, helps in part. But any time you develop an eligibility for anything, you create some disparate impacts, and then it's our job to deal with those and to try to help families and students deal with that, with those kinds of challenges more directly. I think we have one-stop student service program that I think is about the best you can find anywhere where our talented people come to work with our families and our students to try to solve these problems. But I do think in this range above, you do have some difficulties, and we're beginning to address them. Well, anyway, the point I'm really trying to make here is that this is a very pervasive kind of planning effort, and I haven't even talked about what we're doing to try to improve the organization and management of the University of Minnesota along the way here, but I may have a couple of opportunities to make a comment or two about that along the way. I was also asked to comment on the last appropriation and what happened to it. I can tell you we put it to very good use, and I want to thank members of the legislature and the governor for appropriating about 85% of the university's request last year in a time that was kind of challenging, quite honestly. We were coming out of the recession and a pretty deep deficit. We requested $126 million, and you can see in this graph how we allocated that money into sort of rough areas of investment and costs facing the University of Minnesota. We received about $106 million. $41 million in the first year and $23 million in the second. And the money was allocated and spent in relationship to what we proposed in the biennial budget request in these particular categories. Let me give you just a couple of examples. In the area of biosciences for a healthy society, 20%, 27%, we made a number of very, very important investments. We started the initial down payment on a new medical devices center that brings scientists together from multiple fields across the university, put some new money into a nanotechnology research center. All of these centers are now leveraging new opportunities for grants and contracts and grants and contracts with business and industry. We put $1 million into clinical sciences development programs, mostly in the academic health center. Invested $250,000 in infectious diseases in the College of Veterinary Medicine. 10 of the 11 most difficult infectious diseases in humans have started with animals, had their origin with animals in the last several years. We put $1.3 million into a university-wide education and research initiative we called Healthy Foods, Healthy Lives. It's a connection between foods, nutrition, and human health. We started a down payment on transforming the educational platform and the educational strategies in the Academic Health Center. In the old days, you'd go into Mayo Auditorium, there'd be a professor, a talking head, and 500 people listening to the lecture. We're moving much more to use of simulation, other kinds of learning platforms that we think are very, very promising. We have particular challenges in recruiting and retaining students in particular fields of the biological sciences, and we put some investment in those areas as well, and also some investment in what we call translational research grants. We think that one of the big challenges now is to make the link between basic discovery and application. That's called translational research in many areas, and so we're trying to incent that kind of work, trying to bring people together to speed up the pace of translating basic discoveries into applications that can really improve our health. Competitive compensation was last year and is this year a major priority of the University of Minnesota, and what we tried to do here is differentially allocate this money into fields and individuals who are under very, very competitive market pressure. Take a field like chemical engineering and material science. Everyone knows that the university's department is in the top three and generally the first in the country each and every year. And what are you going to do to keep those people? A very large percentage of them get competitive offers every year. And so this is an attempt to try to identify those fields where we have distinction, where we have a real distinct profile of accomplishment, and it's a try to keep those fields really strong, particularly if they're important to the future of the University of Minnesota. So this compensation plan was over and above the regular merit-based compensation plan to deal and address serious market problems, and I'll come back to that in presenting the biennial request. It's a continuing problem. We think it's a 6 to 8 year strategy here at the University of Minnesota. Technology was a part of the last budget. It is a part of this one as well. There were investments in high performance research networks, investments to try to extend the benefits of those networks to Rochester, Minnesota, to support the platform of the Mayo University Partnership. Would have cost millions of dollars to do that without the University of Minnesota. If you had to do that from Chicago rather than the Twin Cities, cost roughly $250,000 in this way. New investments in data storage systems to support research, classrooms, new advising and portal systems to support students. So that was at least part of the technology investments, and some work on imaging, security, other areas that are really critical to the University of Minnesota that we would, I guess, characterize as part of the technology backbone and infrastructure. Research support comprised about 20% of this budget, and we looked at the allocations. Give you a few examples, a $200,000 grant to really improve investment in the Freshwater Research Center at UMD. It was on television, I think, this morning or last night, some of the work that's going on there. About $300,000 for research activities in global climate change related to the environment, and some members of the House and Senate have heard some testimony on that work. a new hire in horticulture, about $320,000 for research in food and agricultural systems, targeted faculty positions in fields that were really critical across the University of Minnesota, including the College of Liberal Arts, the Institute of Technology, and then increased support for libraries, a growing area of pressure at the University of Minnesota, and grant and aid for graduate student support. There were other investments in students as a part of this budget. We put some money into merit-based and need-based aid to try to supplement state and federal programs and to keep higher education more affordable and accessible. Significant investment in graduate fellowships. We put $1.5 million to improve graduate assistant salaries, you know, people who are working on state funding to teach classes and to support our faculty. There was even a $10,000 investment in something we call the Restorative Justice Program. Occasionally people misbehave, and this is a very powerful concept that we thought had some real merit. We also developed a very exciting career center on the St. Paul campus that brings the resources of multiple colleges together in one place, a one-stop sort of advisement career center. That gives you just kind of a sense of how we spent the money, and I think spent it very well. This investment, in my judgment, will continue to leverage great returns to the state of Minnesota, and a lot of these investments were in areas that we thought represented unique opportunities and obviously the operating cost needs of the University of Minnesota. People ask me, well, how do you fund this place and what kind of revenues are a part of the University of Minnesota budget? And I want to spend just a few moments on this part of the university to help, I think, lay the foundation for the biennial budget request that I'll talk about in just a few moments. I think the University of Minnesota's economy is one of the most diverse economies you will find anywhere in the state of Minnesota. It has a very diverse revenue mix, but when you strip all these little slices away, there are certain sort of groupings of expenditures that I think make our budget relatively easy to understand. Moody's recently said the following about the University of Minnesota's budget. Moody's believes that the University of Minnesota will maintain a very strong market position as a flagship public University of Minnesota and as one of the nation's leading educational and research institutions, and gave the University of Minnesota a very, very high sort of rating for its bonds. More than half of this budget, about $1.3 billion, is from grants, contracts, gifts, educational sales, and what we call auxiliary enterprises. What is that? You know, parking fees, athletic tickets, many other things that we could talk about. Most of these funds, nearly every dollar in this $1.3 billion is dedicated. It is not what we call fungible. I can't take parking revenues and spend them anywhere at the University of Minnesota without bankrupting parking services and without essentially reducing the cross-subsidy that we put into public transportation for our students, faculty, and staff. The university earns $624 million in sponsored programs, in non-government grants and contracts, additional $264 million in educational sales and activities. What's interesting is how this money is spent. 87% of the money in this part, which is not fungible, can't be used to hire a professor in some other field, was spent on research. So it really funds the research enterprise very substantially at the University of Minnesota. 84% was spent on public service, you know, connecting the university to the needs of Minnesota communities throughout the state of Minnesota. 70% on equipment, 70% on repairs, maintenance, and supplies, just to give you kind of a sense of the impact of this part of our budget. The remainder of this budget, and the part that I think is most germane to our discussion here today, is the state appropriation and tuition and fees. This is what we would characterize as the more fungible part of the university's budget. There are some parts of the state commitment that do have strings and have certain mandates attached to them, but for the most part, this is funding that leverages the rest. So the 26% of our budget that comes from state appropriations, one could argue, really leverages the rest of the budget. And if you look at this next graph, and I thought it was really interesting, Peter Zetterberg put this graph together, and what I loved about this graph was it showed how the state investment leveraged educational sales, contract activity, federal grants and contracts, all the other parts of our budget. But you notice the direction of the arrow. I just love the direction of the arrow. It's going up. I think that's good news. Anyway, let's just talk about tuition and fees and the state appropriations for just a moment. Just what does this pay for in the university's budget? About 70% of the state funding and tuition and fees goes to support the education mission of the university. It's spent directly on instruction. 77% spent on student services, directly supporting students. 54% covers the total compensation cost of the University of Minnesota, but 72, nearly three-quarters of the compensation costs for our faculty who do research and teaching. The college budgets are kind of interesting. 93% of the budget for the College of Liberal Arts comes from tuition and state appropriation, 7% from other sources, 78% of the Institute of Technology, 75% of the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, just to name a few examples. This money also allows us to make some very important investments. New hires in the Cancer Center, one of the federally designated centers that just received a $20 million five-year grant. The Freshwater Research Center I mentioned just a few moments ago, the Center for Transportation Studies, and I mentioned the St. Paul Career Center. So you can see that this part of our budget very, very substantially covers sort of the core academic mission. And if you think about it the way economists would think about a budget, it is the part of the budget that leverages the rest. Without that state commitment, there would be no tuition and fees. There would be no grants and contracts. And the grants and contracts and royalty income of the University of Minnesota this last year actually will pretty much equal, if not exceed, the state investment today, just taking one slice of this pie. So the point is that I want to make is this 26% of the budget, 26 cents of every dollar we expend on an annual basis, has a tremendous multiplier effect on Minnesota's economy and quality of life, and a tremendous return on investment. I think that way about education at all levels, to be honest with you, but that's a different talk than the one I've been asked to give here this afternoon. Now I'd like to segue, if there are no more questions about this.
President Brunis, let's see if there are any more questions, because this
questions.
Next section is when we're going
to
have members join you at the table.
Right.
Anything about the 05 preparation that we did? Any other questions for President Brunix? President Brunix, since we're still talking about the past before we move into the future, could you just make a few comments about, you know, what happened with the Gopher Stadium and some of the issues around the extra $40 million? Okay. I think members are maybe interested and maybe too shy to ask the question, so.
Okay. I'll try not to be too shy to give an answer. The stadium estimate was about 3 years old. And, of course, during that period of time, we've seen an explosion in the inflationary rate in the construction industry, most notably in the cost of concrete and steel. And this is a big structure. So about $12.5 million, I want to give a sense of what led to the $40 million and then answer how we're going to pay for it. About $12.5 million of this was just inflation over and above the 5.5% inflation that the Department of Finance and others felt was reasonable to project that period of time. So that was about $12.5 million of the 40, so that left about roughly 27.5. Most of those costs are costs that we felt were necessary to do it right, to build this thing in the right way. What are they? When we started to plan the stadium, it was out sort of in the back 40, of the university's campus. And since then, we've decided through our master planning exercises that we need to locate some very significant research buildings around the periphery of the campus and on the back side of the stadium. So the stadium was not bricked all the way around because it was going to basically, the backside was going to overlook some railroad tracks. So we decided that was something that we could not afford to ignore, and so that was a cost.
So that was the cost to put the
brick wall? No. I'm just giving you the cost that make up the $40 million and the part that does not deal with inflation.
So, I'm trying to understand that because I didn't understand what the connection was between the railroad tracks and the brick wall and the research buildings.
Well, when we planned the stadium, there were very few plans to expand that area of the campus.
Okay.
We have since revisited those ideas, and we now believe that that's the most promising area to locate some of the new research buildings over the next 10 to 15 years. We've completed one, the Lyons Lab and the McGuire Building. Mm-hmm. We have the Magnetic Resonance Research Center there now, which is one of the best centers of its kind in the world. We are building a new building authorized by the last legislative session, a new building on biomedical research will go in that area. Mm-hmm. And there are plans to probably locate two more there sometime over the next 10 years. So we felt... when we looked at this and felt and looked at the infrastructure needs of that part of the campus, we realized that we were expanding the university's Twin Cities campus by about 70 acres, not just the 12 or so for the stadium. And we needed to make it look like it was an integral part of the University of Minnesota. So that was one of the cost elements. We didn't have that in the original cost. Secondly, we decided the footprint of the stadium should be increased slightly. We increased by a couple of inches the size of the seats and the space between the rows. And when you did that, that really substantially increased. We decided that if we were ever going to expand the stadium, the time to put down the foundations to do that, another $3 to $5 million was now rather than 15 years from now, sometime in the future. And there were other kinds of upgrades that had to do with changes in regulations, stormwater management, to name one, and a few other things. But all of that aggregated inflation and all of these improvements that we thought were necessary to about $40 million. Are we going to fund it? The cost of money is moving in our direction. There are very substantial cost savings in the funding of the stadium because of the lower cost of money. We projected about 5.5%, and it's now running closer to 4%. That saved the state of Minnesota nearly $30 million on the bonds, and it's also saving some as far as our cost of the stadium. And that will leave about $25 million that we have to solve on our own. We'll solve that through a combination of private fundraising and athletic revenues, mostly coming from increased television revenues under a new contract. So we think we can manage this. It's not going to be easy, but we made a pledge, and we're going to keep our promise that we're not putting any more off on the backs of our students, and we're not coming back to the state of Minnesota. This has to be done by University of Minnesota resources.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, then does the order on my agenda make sense for you?
Yes. Perfect.
Okay. Then Senator Tomasoni, if you want to just join President Brunix, and you can say a few words about compensation as he explains that initiative, or you can explain that initiative.
Hey, if you would mind, could I just make a couple of preliminary remarks to kind of frame the structure? And I'd love to do it in your presence, Senator Tomasoni. Anyway, what I'd like to do is just give you a quick overview of the framework, the architecture of the biennial budget request, and then, as I understand it, different sections are going to be authored by different members of the committee.
So right, and for those of you who came late, those bills will be introduced on Thursday. So we'll actually have the bills in front of us on Thursday to act on.
Great. Well, if you look at this slide in front of you and materials you have at your table, the budget is organized into two broad categories. One we call sustaining quality and competitiveness, and basically this is a part of the budget that covers the core operating expenses of the University of Minnesota with one exception. It covers a compensation item for faculty and staff, an investment in advancing education and supporting education of our students. Again, as you saw in the last biennial request, continued investment in technology and related infrastructure. I think you can expect to see that. As far as the eye can see, that's a continuing cost pressure, not just at the University of Minnesota, but around the country. You'll see below the line on the yellow side of the chart, facilities, operations, and maintenance. That's a little over $30 million over the next 2 years, and we are not asking the state to fund that, but it is very much a part of our operating costs and our budget. We're reallocating internally to cover those costs using privately raised funds in a few cases, and that's basically our responsibility.
But you have a capital budget request.
Yes, but these are for new facilities,
okay.
Things, the new buildings that are opening, facilities where we have our side of the debt equation,
okay.
where we have the one-third debt, where we have additional operating expenses. That's basically what this is all about. And then core maintenance. We are increasing some of our maintenance budgets this year as well. Creating Minnesota's future is all about investment that we think is critically important to improve the excellence, the quality, the impact of the University of Minnesota. It asks to make some very important investments that we think map to the strengths, comparative advantages of the University of Minnesota that address very serious needs of our state, that invest in areas that we think are some natural opportunities for not only the University of Minnesota, but for Minnesota generally. And so we call that creating Minnesota's future. That's all about advancing, improving, and strengthening our core capacity in areas that we think represent some real long-term advantage. And then you can see in this next diagram, and we can come back to that, leave it up here, how the budget is organized. You see the university reallocation, the $34.5 million. That's mostly new buildings. Operating expenses are part of the debt load for buildings at the University of Minnesota and miscellaneous things. Tuition we put at 4.5%. I'll come back and talk about that. And then we're asking for the state investment that you see in the two columns under sustaining quality and creating the future, adding up to, if you use biennial math, a mathematical system that I'm less comfortable with, it comes to $182.3 million for the biennium. So with that, I think we could go through each of the sections, Senator Pappas, and we could introduce the different parts of the biennial budget.
Okay. Senator Tominsoni.
Thank you, and welcome. President Brunix, was that new math? Because I remember in about the sixth grade we had something called
I
new
think
math.
Biennial math is more like fuzzy math.
Okay, fuzzy math, okay. You know, Madam Chair, so you oftentimes hear that the University of Minnesota is the engine that drives the economic engine that drives the state, and it's an interesting analogy of the university's role in this state. I want to add to something that President Brunix mentioned about the discovery of taconite, because had that discovery not been done at the University of Minnesota, I'm not sure what the future of the Iron Range could have been or would have been. And as a result of that discovery, university trust lands have been mined because of the rich deposits of ore that we have there. And there have been scholarship funds created as a result of these trust lands. And right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, sir, but I believe that 20% of all the incoming freshmen at all the campuses of the University of Minnesota are receiving either a $1,000 or a $2,000 Iron Range scholarship as a result of these trust funds that have been created. And none of that would have happened had it not been for the discovery of the taconite process at the University of Minnesota. So it's a pretty interesting full circle that it comes back to.
Are those the PUF funds?
Those are the PUF funds.
Yeah, and that's pretty accurate. Craig, that's a pretty accurate number, isn't it?
And I also believe
from all over this, these students are not just from the area.
No,
they come from all over the state of Minnesota.
And is that need based scholarship?
No, they're not need based scholarships. You actually have to be very smart to get them. Of course, you have to be smart to get into the university, so that has something to do with it. but they also fund endowed chairs. That same PUF fund also funds the endowed chairs that do some of the research. So it's interesting.
Who manages that? Who makes the decisions about how that money is going to be spent?
Chair Pappas, members of the committee, those decisions are made on the recommendation of academic officers, let's say deans, let's say they want to retain a faculty member or hire a new faculty member, and they're usually made on the recommendation of a substantial gift. And so the PUF professorship and chair program is a matching program against private gifts, and it was started in the 1980s. We've expensed most of the money, but there's still some to go. And at the time when the endowed chair program was started, and this goes to the heart of what Senator Tomasoni is talking about, is we had 15 of these chairs and professorships at the University of Minnesota. We're closing in on 400 now. And they're not just on the Twin Cities campus. They're in other campuses of the university as well. So it's had, without this partnership, you know, with Northern Minnesota and the legislature to create this PUF fund, the University of Minnesota wouldn't be anything like what it is today. It's had a really
How much money
impact.
Does it bring in every year?
Well, right, it's fixed. Actually, the PUF fund gets replenished every year. The endowment grows by some amount, and half of it goes into a research fund to advance research, mostly in minerals and mineral research, right?
Madam Chair, I believe, if I remember correctly, this last year there was $3.8 million going into scholarships, and then it's a like amount was going into research.
Right. Okay.
And that's up from about $2.5 million from prior years. And so it's a result of the mining, and it's also a result of the return on the funds themselves.
Right, on the investment.
And there's something in the area of over $100 million is in both funds right now. Madam Chair, the general compensation bill that I have is about a $69.5 million request that or is it 67?
67, but we'll take the 69.
$69.5 million, what I got here. It's gone down. It's almost two-thirds of the university's annual operating budget, and it's devoted to salaries. And the request is based on a general salary increase of about 3.5% each year. And I know last year there was a salary increase, but I believe that in the prior biennium there was a salary freeze. So I think this is trying to not only do the right thing, but maybe catch up a little bit on something I didn't have before.
And I think the difference in the numbers, this is a preliminary budget. I think there was some reduction in fringe benefit costs, and so that lowered the total amount we needed.
Any questions?
And this is the core compensation that covers all faculty and staff.
Right. So this is part of the basic infrastructure of the university.
Basic core support.
Okay, thank you, Senator Tomasoni. I said we'll have the bill back and take action on Thursday. Senator Cohen isn't here, so President Brunix, why don't you just go ahead and explain the next one, advancing education.
I believe Senator Cohen is going to author this section of our bill, and it's about advancing education. It's nearly $25 million. There are a number of very important initiatives that have grown out of what I was describing as the university's strategic planning efforts. It's all about attracting and supporting and retaining and improving results for undergraduate, graduate, and professional students. Just to give you some examples, the university is really implementing a very ambitious university-wide writing initiative, expanding undergraduate research opportunities. We think this is one of the distinctive aspects of our profile, where our students can actually work with our faculty in laboratories and in fields and field studies and other places. There's money for graduate student support, an expansion of a university-wide honors program under the direction of the provost on the Twin Cities campus, substantial investments in improving advisement and career services, and then some modest funding to leverage private support for the Founders Free Tuition program. So that gives you kind of a sample of what we're trying to do under the category of advancing education. And again, this is a statewide investment that would benefit all the campuses of the University of Minnesota.
We did put technology and related infrastructure in with that category, too.
Let me just talk about that. This is, again, a renewal of what you saw in the last biennial request. Not too long ago, I asked some people to go out and conduct a very rigorous survey at the local level and in relationship to the cost structure of the University of Minnesota. to find out what were the factors really driving the costs of the university so that we could better manage them. And three things came out as the primary cost drivers: people, because, you know, 70 cents for every dollar we spend at the University of Minnesota goes to people. And we're a very human capital intensive organization. The second had to do with buildings and laboratories and the renewal of our capital investment. And the third was technology and related infrastructure. This is an area of investment that is increasing, not just here but on other campuses as well. But we tend to run the most technologically advanced laboratories and operations in the state. So this is all about funding that technology backbone, the advances and expansions under Internet 2 and the National Lambda Rail that some of you know about. It's about investing in the infrastructure. Security is getting increasingly to be a challenging issue, particularly in a large, complex place like ours. So we have money in here for security upgrades. A good deal of this is going into the sort of the educational platform, increasing the investment in technology that supports the learning of our students, high-performance networks, classroom technology, and that sort of gives you a sense of some of what we're trying to accomplish in this particular area of investment. And one of the things that I think is not sufficiently understood about the university is this is kind of the hub and the backbone for Minnesota, and a lot of what comes in here goes out and benefits Minnesota's businesses. I mentioned the Mayo University partnership, and for $250,000, these high-speed networks are going down to Rochester. I think it's roughly that amount of money, and it's a big part of what makes Minnesota work, to be honest with you. There are even connections to the K-12 Minsky campuses, and I'm sure if you look at their budget, they've got to have some substantial investment in this area as well.
And this is a request for base money, not one time?
All of the funds that I'm going to talk about, are the entire request is in terms of base adjustment, mm-hmm. recurring dollars. The governor's recommendation had some mixture of recurring and non-recurring dollars. But we've asked for recurring dollars because these are all, in our judgment, recurring expenses.
Any questions? Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the previous section,
advancing education.
Compensation. Mm-hmm. Is it okay to ask a
sure.
question? Thank you. And President Brunix, on compensation, I know you need to attract and retain the best you can. How comparable would the benefit package be with competition?
President Brunix.
Chair Pappas, Senator Rieger, I think if you compare, what we do is benchmark ourselves against peer groups. And so each campus will have a somewhat different peer group, and then, of course, we benchmark for the system as a whole. And I would say our benefits, that is, your fringe benefits of health and retirement, are probably in the top half of our peer groups, close to the middle, but slightly better. Our salaries are lower than that. So if you add total compensation, for example, on the Twin Cities campus, and you look at faculty, faculty will be in the bottom third of their peer group, closer to 25th to 27th. We have adjusted our fringe benefits very substantially. If you recall, a few years ago, we took a 15% base hit, reduction in our budget, $185 million over 2 years in state support. And in that period of time, we took a hard wage freeze. We also asked our employees to take real cuts in health benefits, and those savings were about $50 million a year at the University of Minnesota. So everybody has the co-pays, and everybody has the same kind of structure that you see in the private markets. If you compare our health care plan to the private sector or peer groups, it would be sort of in the middle of the range. In some areas it might be more generous, but it's a good health care plan. But I think it's competitive with the marketplace. I think it'd be slightly better than the private sector.
How about
Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, thank you. How about retirement?
The retirement program, Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling, the retirement program at the University of Minnesota, the vested retirement program for faculty would be somewhat better than peer group institutions. The salaries would be somewhat lower. So when you put them all together, I still think the compensation levels are not as high as they should be. But we have there may be a percentage or two more than the average of the peer group in vested retirement, and our faculty have felt that that's a better way to take their compensation. But even with that, total compensation, faculty, for faculty especially, is lagging behind the competitive peers around the country.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling.
And so I'm assuming that that salary is directly associated, though, with retirement benefits later on. What is correlation?
President Brunig?
Yes. There are different programs. Our Chair Pappas, Senator Roebling, the bargaining unit staff will generally have a different health care plan. For example, many of them are in the state, not health care, excuse me, retirement plan. Many of them are in a state retirement plan. Civil service people, for example, are in a state plan. A faculty retirement plan is based on income, but it's capped at, I think, salaries of slightly over $200,000. So you get a certain percentage up to that amount, and then it's capped. But it is based on income.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll have Senator Michelle will join you to talk about competitive compensation.
Chair Pappas, thank you for the assignment. members, the competitive compensation part of the university's request, I think it's pretty simple. So to kind of lay it out here, the idea is if you get great faculty and staff, that will help attract great students, which in turn will attract the research and the patents. And it's just an ongoing snowball. This request is above and beyond the merit increases that Senator Tomasoni and President Brunix just talked about. This is a request for $9.8 million in 08 and 09. And it would be for a pool of funds to address competitive market compensation. This is how you recruit. This is how you reward, and this is how you retain the best faculty, not only in the country, but now this is a worldwide market. We all met with Dr. Firpo a couple weeks ago, and we got her from California. We got her from California, and so this is a tool.
She was just in the newspaper. There was that article on biosciences.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. And did you all read the article? Because at one point they said that she speaks to a lot of different groups and even gives tours to legislators. And I thought, that was us.
And even, huh?
Yeah.
Even, right.
It sounded like it was a bit of a chore for her.
It was a chore. Yeah, she doesn't like
it. I can assure you.
Takes time away from her research.
But a couple of other numbers to note here, Chair Pappas. There's a constant churn that goes on with university faculty. Each year, the university hires approximately 120 new faculty. So this is a daily issue for President Brunix and his crew. Wow. And to answer a bit more of Senator Wieger's question earlier, the numbers that I have here in FY05, the Twin Cities campus ranked 22nd among the top 30 research universities in average compensation.
Total.
An average total compensation. So, again, this is a pool which can be used on a selective basis to try to get the best. President Brunix?
Well, I think Senator Michelle really put the case pretty clearly. The only thing I would add is we expect to replace about half the faculty across the campuses of the University of Minnesota in the next roughly 7 to 10 years. And this is something we're going to have to address if we want to keep ourselves in a really competitive position. The other thing I would say is that every year, other colleges and universities, not just in the United States but across the world, come calling and try to hire 60 to 75 of our very best people. And so what this is all about is not any kind of cross the board or even a merit-based increase. It's based on market and merit considerations in those fields that are most at risk in this highly competitive market. And we just think one way or the other, we have to do this. We just have to, you know, we just have to start working on this problem. And we see this now as, I think, roughly a 6 to 8 year challenge that we have before us. And we made some real inroads last year. I think we need to do this every year for the next 6 to 8 years to put us in the right kind of position to keep the academic programs of the university strong for the foreseeable future. You don't have to do that in all fields. And this is a very disciplined process where we really look at the numbers. We really benchmark the fields. We benchmark the competition. We take a look at the 60 to 75 people that are under these competitive pressures and try to make adjustments to make sure that our compensation system, it's going to raise the average, but it's much more targeted than the usual compensation approach.
Okay, any questions? All right, thank you, Senator Michelle. Senator Sharon, Health Workforce and Clinical Sciences.
As Senator Sharon joins me, the other thing I would say is that 70% of the employees at the University of Minnesota are on a merit pay system, and only 30% are under bargaining unit contracts.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair Pappas, and hello.
Good to see you again.
It's good to see you again. We ran into each other at Almanac one night, so.
She was smoking and I was talking about the University of Minnesota.
I was smoking by the time that was over.
But only outside in the 20 degree below weather.
I wasn't really smoking, it was just an image.
We were wondering.
This item is a Health Workforce and Clinical Sciences appropriation. The university is requesting $8.8 million in 2008 and $10.3 million in 2009 for a total of $19,100,000. And it's to be used in three areas: health workforce,
their money,
health education initiatives, and clinical sciences. Yeah. And I think Dr. Bruna can explain them better, but I think that I'd like to at least speak to the health workforce background. Of course, you know that the university has as a central role the development and the growth of the health care workforce in the state of Minnesota. So a part of this proposal includes a center for allied health programs, which will be based in Twin Cities and in Rochester, and it's to expand enrollments in medical technology and occupational therapy. The second health workforce initiative is the Doctoral of Nursing Practice. And we heard testimony the other day about the shortages of nurses. One of the barriers to nurse preparation is the ability to have enough doctorally prepared nurses to be able to help develop the advanced practice nurses. And this doctorate of nursing practice will establish new professional doctorate program that's applied, and it will help mitigate the shortage by graduating individuals who will be prepared to teach future nurses. Then the third is the Center of American Indian and Minority Health. This is really an exciting project, but it is a project that has experienced cuts from the federal government, so it's important for us to be able to find money to help develop a pathway for persons who might not usually be recruited and prepared in the healthcare system to be able to serve the public. Then the second area is health education initiatives. In this area, there are a number of initiatives. One is an interprofessional educational program, which will bring students from the various kinds of health professionals together to learn how to work collaboratively as healthcare teams rather than in silos. So it's a new educational initiative on how to train healthcare professionals. Another, which is one of my absolute favorite ones that I really like to see being promoted more and more, are patient simulations used as a way of training health professionals of the future. And that's because the clinical environments are very hard to give the students the direct patient service experiences. So this is a new style of education that allows students to have repetitious experience without having to overload the patient with students always trying to do procedures on a live human being. The only thing I would ask in this is to make sure that nurses are included in the process of being able to have simulation experiences. Then the third in this area is the area health education centers. These are hubs out in the rural part of the state that provide educational opportunities for people in the rural part of the state, and also have an important role in helping create interest in the K-12 population in health professions. And then the third area that I mentioned were the clinical sciences. This is really an exciting project if funded. It has to do with developing research corridors that moves the development of new treatments and cures from research into actual clinical practice. So with that, I'll just turn it over and have you explain it further.
Good. Well, no, I think you did as well as I could do. I'm impressed because that's a part of our budget that I have to really study and practice in presenting. Let me just say one thing about the clinical science investment. It's estimated today that it takes about 17 years for a discovery in the basic sciences to find its way into clinical application, if that's a new drug or a new procedure. And we really think part of the reason for this is that places like the University of Minnesota have underinvested in these what we call translational sciences, where you have to bring teams together in different ways to figure out, you know, the best applications and the fastest way to get those applications.
Do you think
practice.
That's because the old way of looking at things was that the private sector would do that?
Chair Pappas, I think that's part of it.
Or the federal government would fund it.
Yeah, and part of what's happening is the federal government has funded sort of the basic research, and now more and more is starting to fund clinical translational kinds of work. But business and industry, if you look at the trend lines, is reducing its investment in this area, looking more and more to universities like ours for some of the basic R&D work. They still do the translational work to take an idea to scale. You know, if you have to take a new drug and put it into a product line and get it out into the marketplace, they still do a lot of that work. But they're the old Bell Labs, basic science labs that were attached to business and industry, those are pretty much gone now. And now you're seeing more and more emerging partnerships between universities and the private sector. So when I saw this statistic, 17 years to get some of these basic ideas from the bench to the bedside, I thought, my God, my age, you know, I'm three weeks from a Medicare card. We got to speed this up.
We'd like a little more speed on Alzheimer's research.
Yeah, right. We got to get moving here.
17 years.
Anyway, thank you.
I think we'd like a little more speed on the Alzheimer's research, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't I just say that? Does anybody else want to repeat that again?
What?
I saw it. I never thought I'd see such high theater in the Minnesota State Legislature. Just wait quick.
Thank you. How many House colleagues do we have here? Just
the other thing I would say, and to reinforce what Senator Sharon said, one of the biggest problems we have is the nursing shortage here and around the country. And one of the biggest problems in creating that shortage is that we don't have enough faculty to actually teach in these programs. And so the program that we're talking is about preparing future faculty. That's the main focus.
Any questions on this item? Then let's have Senator Lynch. Science and Engineering.
Okay. Madam Chair.
I'm glad we got through health. Health and injury.
It's exciting to be here and hear about the many initiatives that the university is proposing to enable it to become better and stronger, particularly in areas that have the strongest potential for growth in our economy. And I'm here today to present the science and engineering request. That's a $15.6 million request. And as we think about it, I think that we can all agree that some of the most serious challenges that we face, whether it's in energy or health or the environment, medicine, many of those things will be addressed through innovative and cross-disciplinary research. Members of the committee, many of us had the opportunity to go to the university recently on tour, and one of the very unique, innovative places that we had the opportunity to visit was that nanotechnology lab, as you'll recall. In order that the university can remain a leader and forefront of such research, they are proposing investments in medical device center, neuroscience, the nanotechnology, and creation of a civil engineering program at the University of Minnesota Duluth, as I understand it. So with that, I'll ask President Brunings if he'd like to comment further.
Well, those are the major Senator Lynch has really talked about the major investments, and some of these were also referenced in the last biennial request. For example, I mentioned some startup investment in medical devices. I mentioned nanotechnology. Again, these are multiple-year investment strategies. And I think one of the things that we should think about in this particular area is what's happening around us in Minnesota businesses and industries. We have about 500 medically related businesses and industries in Minnesota. We all know the big medical device industries, and they come quickly to mind. But there are many, many others, you know, startup companies and so forth that depend on this kind of science and technology. And increasingly, nanotechnology is going to drive this agenda. It was really interesting. Last night I was sort of thumbing through magazines that had arrived, you know, earlier in the day, and the Harvard Business Review had a whole section on nanotechnology. You know, I didn't expect Harvard Business Review to really care that much about it, but they see it as one of the leading wedge technologies in the future. And it's going to revolutionize everything from consumer electronics to medical devices and many of the other things that are part of our everyday life. And so the university just fortunately is strong in this area due to some investments we made a long time ago in hiring some of the right people. But it's an area that we need to keep strong given the other things that are important in Minnesota's economy. And the Medical Device Center, too, would bring people together across multiple fields, people from medicine, material science, many of the other fields, that medicinal chemistry, the new laboratory that we talked about that Dr. Gundy-Georg is developing. She's one of the finest people in the world in this area. It took us 5 years to recruit her from the University of Kansas. And increasingly, medicinal chemistry and devices.
President Brunings, is she here yet, or is she waiting for that lab to be remodeled?
She is here now. She is.
She is here. So is she working out a temporary lab space?
We outfitted part of her laboratories, and now we have in our capital request, I think about an $18 million, $17 or $18 million investment to complete the remodeling of the laboratories.
Okay.
But I think we did some early stage work, right?
Two floors?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any questions on this section from any of the committee members?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Senator Lynch. Senator Latz, Environment, Ag Systems, and Renewable Energy.
Mr. President, Madam Chair, I'm almost going to say I forgot what I was supposed to be presenting to you today. But,
I'm right
not
here.
Yet.
I'm
not
right
yet.
Here to remind you.
I can give you the budget page.
Yes, no, I've got the budget page. Thank you. Madam Chair, this is the portion of the budget relating to environment, agricultural systems, and renewable energy. The total request for this upcoming biennium is $11.5 million. It's broken into a couple of categories. For fiscal 08, it's $3,100,000. Second half of the biennium, it's 8.4. And the reason for the disparity, I think, is largely because the Institute on the Environment is in the startup phase. It has an interim director. They have not yet hired a permanent director for that, and they're getting geared up, getting funding in the pipeline. What's being asked for here is funding which will be the long-term sustainable ongoing budget. There are some special initiatives that are related to some of this work, for which funding is being sought, not in this particular budget, but perhaps from other sources in the state's budget process. The Institute on the Environment is another of the multidisciplinary efforts at the university, and one of the highlights of it is the Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment called IRE. This is where much of the effort will be focused on biofuel, ethanol, and probably more importantly, what comes after ethanol. Ethanol is largely recognized now as an important but transitional kind of energy resource, important obviously to Minnesota's economy, but only marginally positive in terms of the amount of energy you get out compared to the amount of energy that you put in. The next generation of renewable energy sources will come from cellulose-based energy sources, higher sugar content kind of areas, and they will be not only more profitable for Minnesota's agricultural sector, but also more beneficial for the environment. So this is one area that is important to fund as part of this budget request. Another part is the safety net for Minnesota's plants and animals with regard to disease concerns, and that is there's $8 billion of crops and livestock raised in Minnesota, and this is the part of the budget where the University of Minnesota does a lot of research on the prevention and treatment of those kinds of diseases. The veterinary diagnostic laboratory is the other big part of this. They're asking for several million dollars to refurbish and expand the existing laboratory, which is at capacity right now. Whenever a farm animal dies in Minnesota and the farmer takes some tissue samples to determine what the disease was that caused the death, and they send that sample in, now they can send it to a facility in Brookings, South Dakota, or they can send it to this lab at the University of Minnesota. And that is how, within 24 hours, hopefully the lab can make a determination as to cause of death, can post that information on a limited access computer system so that the farmer can find out what the cause was, but the university can aggregate the information and find out if there are any early warning signs for at risk for livestock in Minnesota. But the lab is at capacity, and if there are any large-scale outbreaks, they would be hard-pressed to be able to process in a timely fashion all of the needed evaluations. So that's basically, I think, the guts of this request, and who wants to expand on that?
President Brunix?
No, I think Senator Latz really covered this area very, very well. The only thing I would say in response to this whole set of initiatives under Creating Minnesota's Future is a part of our strategic planning and positioning. It's a lot of jargon, and it sounds like a lot of process, but it was all about trying to identify where the university needed to be strong, where the university had strengths, where we felt we had comparative advantages, and then to think thoughtfully about the connection of those strengths and comparative advantages to the strengths and comparative advantages of Minnesota. So why would the university care about biofuels? Because we're positioned as a state to be one of the strongest states in the world economy, you know. And why would we care about the connection of foods to human health? Because we have 400 food companies in Minnesota, and it's a big part of our economy. And so why would we care about the arts and the connection of the arts to the broader community? Because we have one of the most vibrant arts cultures in the state of Minnesota. So a lot of this has been about shaping the ideas of our budget request, not just saying how much money do we want to spend, But where do we really need to drive the university's agenda, and how do we make these investments that not only improve the quality and the performance and the impact of the University of Minnesota, but how do we do it in such a way that creates real synergism between the university and where the state needs to go in improving our economy and quality of life? And I think you're going to see these themes come back, you know, year after year, not necessarily with the same words, but the same type of thinking is driving the way we're thinking about the University of Minnesota and how we need to think about managing our resources. And so, I started by talking about the breadth of fields at the university. Well, at one time when I came before the legislature as a provost, that I think was a Senate committee, we talked about whether we were a mile wide and an inch deep, and we were trying to do too many things. Now, in this interdisciplinary world, it matters that people are studying cancer in animals and talking to the people in the cancer center who are studying cancer in human beings. And the connections there are profoundly important, and they're profoundly important to advancing science and also promoting human health. So that's a lot of what went into this, you know, to try to come back to the earlier question you asked, well, what does strategic positioning mean, and what does it have to do with this budget? Are these things connected or disconnected? And I'd say they're highly, highly aligned, highly integrated, as we've tried to put this together. I must say that, was this the last section that
Well, I just wanted to ask Senator Senjum, if you would mind waiting until Thursday to talk about the HEPA request. Is that okay,
Madam Chair,
with you?
I would not mind at all because I don't know what my crest is, and no problem
great.
At all.
Because I know President Brunig wanted to talk a little bit about tuition and the last couple pages in your presentation, and I wanted to finish up with this part.
Well, Senator Pappas, I just wanted to say this is the first time we've had this kind of a format in presenting the university's budget, and I can tell you I enjoyed the presentations of your colleagues much more than I would have enjoyed my own. It was really very interesting to hear.
Yeah. Well, we did a little bit of this 2 years ago, but
yeah.
We're just
I thought it was
trying to get more members a little more engaged and involved with the university.
Well, it was very effective, I think, and I really appreciate it. Let me talk a little bit about tuition, because I think we all know that we've been on a roller coaster ride, and it's been really tough on students and families. If you look at the far left side of this graph, you can see what happened during the throes of the recession when we really took the big budget hit here and in Minsky. We really pushed very, very hard on tuition as one of the ways to solve the budget problem. During this period I mentioned a few moments ago, we also took a hard wage freeze. We pushed $50 million a year in benefit cost reductions onto the backs of our employees. It was a tough time of sacrifice for them. And we cut 500-plus people from the workforce of the University of Minnesota. The point I'm truly, really trying to make is tuition was a part of solving this problem, but more than half of the cost or more than half of the challenge to balance the university's budget and to deal with inflation was not tuition. It was these other things that were really tough medicine and things that we found it necessary to do. Facilities management, the people who take care of the buildings and grounds, the workforce there was reduced by 104 full-time equivalent people just in about an 18-month period. Now we're trying to build some of that back because it's been hard to sort of keep up the quality of service in some of our buildings. Now, I'm not here to complain, but I do want to put the tuition part in some context. We made a deliberate effort to, while we knew we had to raise it, to do everything we could to try to provide financial supports under students, particularly those with the highest need, and also to make sure we took the cuts more deeply in other parts of our budget. You can see what happened when we got a little help from the state. The $105 million that you appropriated allowed us to really ratchet this down. We were still feeling some of these effects in the 2006-07 period. And with the budget you have before you, we're proposing to raise tuition about 4.5% a year back-to-back. That would be about $350 a year per undergraduate student across the campuses of the University of Minnesota. We have tried in setting tuition to really look at some important long-term principles. We think higher education should continue to be accessible and affordable for our students. Tuition is 20% roughly of the university's budget, and so it does cover a good deal of the costs of the university, and it has to be a part of ensuring and supporting the quality of education that students have a right to expect when they come to the campuses of the university. I'm, as a first-generation college student who earned his way through an undergraduate and then education and beyond, I feel these issues very intently, but I also know we're probably not going to go back to a period when tuition wasn't a part or wasn't a very substantial part of the University of Minnesota budget. It will be now and in the future. We think it should be more predictable, quite honestly, and we think if we get predictability and state support, we can do our best to make tuition increases more predictable. And we think we have to increasingly benchmark these to the costs that cost increases, something called the Higher Education Price Index, which is a basket full of costs that higher education tracks. It tends to run about 50% above the CPI because it's more heavily weighted to human capital concerns, what it takes to hire and keep people, than is the CPI. We've done a lot of things. I could talk to you about sort of cost economies. We're really focusing as a part of strategic planning and positioning on how do we control our costs, how do we buy fuel more effectively, how do we drive down the cost of fuel consumption. It's nearly $100 million a year across the state of Minnesota to the university. If you eat Cheerios, I want you every time you take a bite to know that you're helping the university stay warm in the winter. We burn oat hulls now rather than putting them into landfills. So we're doing a lot of creative things to drive down costs, going to online catalogs, doing a lot of things that we think are really important. And I think that's something we have to do. We can't just keep raising the costs, raising the ante for students and families in the state of Minnesota. The next diagram, I think, is important. You might say, well, why does the university cost so much? Why are the costs going up so much? Can't you control your costs? And those are good questions, and they ought to be asked of us, and we ought to be accountable for the answers. This graph, though, shows you the annual growth in expenditures for the state of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota for that part of our budget that covers the core operating costs. And you can see the state spending has gone up about 4.9%. We've tracked about 4.3%. One of the messages here is that we're trying, I think this shows a pretty, this is tuition and state support. It shows that the University of Minnesota is not coming here asking for a major budget increase because we aren't managing our own costs. I think this trend line shows that we're doing as well or better than the state in this regard. I mentioned scholarships, and we talked about scholarship support for students. We now give nearly $100 million in institutional grant and gift assistance to students across the campuses of the University of Minnesota. That's largely due to gifts that and internal reallocation of resources, but it's a very, very substantial amount of money. $56 million is awarded to undergraduate students, about $42 million to graduate and first year, our first, what we call first professional students. Our students also get about $60 million in grant and gift assistance from the federal government and state government and outside sources like merit scholarships. So it's a very, when you think about what it takes to help support students, there's a lot of money in the University of Minnesota system and from these other sources to help, but I'd still say we face some very daunting challenges in this area, and we all have to work together to try to solve them. I mentioned the Founders Program, which I think is the most creative program of its kind in the United States. You know, as Senator Roebling rightfully indicated, it doesn't extend as far up the income ladder as I think would be desirable, but that's something that we hope to address in a number of ways in the future. But the point I guess I want to say is that we're working to really try to restrain these costs. I think the best way to restrain tuition cost increases at the University of Minnesota is to invest in the University of Minnesota, hold our feet to the fire, and we'll try to do our part to be a good partner in restraining this growth for students.
President Brunings, we have to close, but I really appreciate the time you spent with us today. And on Thursday, we want to continue with this discussion, take action on the bills that we heard. Senator Roebling is going to talk about the governor's recommendation. We'd like to hear from the university about the governor's recommendation, and then we'll be hearing testimony from student and faculty organizations. The meeting is adjourned.